Other companies are pushing new products at this week's Consumer Electronics Show. It's the biggest annual showcase for anything you want to buy that involves screens, remotes, or buttons. There are more than 100,000 people roaming 1.6 million square feet of floor space. 1.6 million square feet of floor space. It's like, I don't know, maybe 16 gigantic big box stores. Among the people roaming that space is NPR's Laura Seidel, who's on the line. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Steve.
I understand you started off by buying a pedometer. How much have you walked so far?
Well, I would say yesterday alone, I walked over 5 miles, going back and forth from press conferences and demos and luxury hotels.
Wow. Okay. So what did you see?
I saw what I would say the big theme this year is connectivity. So you've got all kinds of connected devices, which we've seen in the past, but what's particularly interesting this year is that you're seeing a lot of connected devices that are talking to each other. So your phone is talking to your TV, things like that. So device talks to device.
Meaning that I can pick up my telephone and what? Call up a program, call up a movie, use it as a remote? What are you talking about?
Well, a variety of things. I think my favorite right now connected device, Sony Ericsson just put out a new phone, or they're about to put out a phone, the Xperia Arc. And this phone, you can, say, watch a movie while you're coming home from work on the train. And when you get home, if you haven't finished the movie, you can connect the phone to your TV and finish watching the movie.
Oh, in the bigger screen that you've presumably got at home now, I suppose.
Exactly. So all those devices are talking to each other, you know, and you're going to have tablet computers that are able to connect to your TV and all sorts of stuff like that. And then there's the cars.
Well, let's talk about the cars. A gentleman was telling me this story about the notion that you could be listening to the radio on your phone, which people now do, internet radio. You get in the car and the car notices that you're listening to the radio and picks it up in the car speakers. Could that be true?
Absolutely. That is distinctly possible because what you're starting to see are internet-connected cars. So this year, Toyota is going to come out with its Entune system. They're going to start putting this in their cars, and there's basically going to be in your car a internet-connected device. There'll be a screen, a touch screen. It'll also have voice recognition. It'll have open table, so you'll be able to, for example, make a reservation at the restaurant you're going to. Let's hope that the voice recognition works well and that you're not using your fingers while you're doing that. But you'll have things like that. You'll also have the possibility of devices that will connect to older cars. So there's a company called Mavizon Technologies, and they've got this device that'll connect to most cars made after 1996. And it will connect your car to the internet. And, for example, if you can't find your car in a parking lot, it'll send a signal to your iPhone telling you where your car is.
Right? Little GPS direction to find it.
Exactly. No, it's great. And believe me, I could use that.
Well, I'd like to know, Laura Seidel, I mean, you cover this all the time. Even the new stuff may be a little old to you. Is there some device that you've run across that really made you stop in your tracks?
Well, here was one that I just found kind of amusing. So, you know, we've had radar detection systems in cars for a while. It lets you know when you're driving along if there's going to be a police car that's trying to track whether you're going too fast. Well, now they have one that is a social radar device. So if your car sees that there is a radar system nearby, it will tweet to other people who have the system and let them know that the cops are there with a speed trap.
Laura Seidel, drive safely out there in Las Vegas, okay?
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve.
NPR's Laura Seidel is at the Consumer Electronics Show.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Blount.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The digital divide has created a chasm between the nation's two biggest bookstore chains. While Borders is trying to hold off bankruptcy, Barnes & Noble today announced its best holiday sales season in more than a decade. The two superstores have been fending off competition from online booksellers and the ebook, but in very different ways. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, Barnes & Noble put its money on a digital device with a catchy name, the Nook.
Thrilled was the word Barnes & Noble Chief Financial Officer Joseph Lombardi used to describe the mood at his company today. Holiday sales at BarnesandNoble.com were up 78% over last year. Store sales increased by almost 10%. And while sales of hardcover books were better than expected, Lombardi made it clear that Barnes & Noble's popular e-readers, the Nook and the Nook Color, were behind the good news.
We made a big decision to invest a lot of money this year in developing, you know, the hardware and software that it has become Nook. And we think we've done the right thing. And I think that's been the most satisfying thing coming out of this holiday for our company.
The Nook is a tide that rises all boats.
James McQuivy is an analyst at Forrester Research. McQuivy says the Nook itself is a popular reading device, but it is also sold in the chain stores. And that, says McQuivy, gives Barnes & Noble an added advantage.
Because people buy the Nook at retail, and then they go and buy digital books, but because they're in the retail location, they might pick something else up while they're there. So the good residual feeling that Barnes & Noble has after Q4 last year is all because of the foot traffic that the Nook drove. That's their salvation right now.
While Barnes & Noble was developing the Nook, Borders was already having financial problems, leaving it ill-prepared to make the investments needed to meet the challenges of the digital age. Michael Norris, an analyst with Simba Information, says some of Borders' problems can be traced back to its leadership.
Because they've actually been through quite a few executives over just a short number of years, and every time there's been an executive change, it basically slows the company down, and it really just hasn't been as nimble or agile as it should have been.
And Norris says even before the onset of e-books, Borders made a crucial error.
For a lot of years, Borders actually relied on Amazon to handle their e-commerce function. So if you were to buy a book from Borders, you would actually be buying it from Amazon, and Amazon would pay Borders a commission. So Borders didn't have a lot of experience developing its own infrastructure. So compared to Barnes & Noble, Borders just really got off to a late start, making the online business and the offline superstore business work as one.
As 2010 drew to a close, Borders announced that it was looking for new financing and delaying payments to some of its vendors. Now, says James McQuivy, it's possible Borders will go under.
There's always a possibility of a resurrection here, but at this point it looks like Borders is probably the Tower Records of books. It is probably the book company most likely to go under and to be that big announcement that causes everyone to finally realize that digital has won the battle.
That's not to say Barnes & Noble doesn't still face its own challenges. McQuivy says once the digital device market is saturated, a bookstore will still have to sell books.
That's the battle for the next couple of years, is how do I get you to buy not just the bestseller on your Nook, but to buy a whole bunch of older titles that you weren't even aware of and weren't even thinking about. And that's what Netflix has done in video. It's what Amazon appears to be doing quite well in the Kindle world, and Barnes & Noble needs to do the same with Nook.
And while Barnes & Noble may lose one of its major competitors, it still has another. Amazon and its popular e-book reader, the Kindle, still dominate the e-book and online market. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Perhaps for the holidays, you get some high-tech clothing, a jacket where your iPhone fits, maybe gloves built in with those speaker microphones. But what if the clothes were the devices themselves, like your polo shirt doubling as a battery pack, each thread a tiny, flexible lithium battery? Well, my next guest may have figured out one of the secrets to get us closer to these futuristic fabrics, a way to take all kinds of material, I mean, batteries, solar cells, superconductors, and twist them into tiny yarns that could be woven into fabric. That work appears this week in the journal Science. Ray Bachman is director of the Nanotech Institute at the University of Texas at Dallas and professor of chemistry there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. It's a great honor to be on NPR. I listen to it all the time.
Thank you very much. Tell us what you about these fibers and how you make them and what you put in them.
Okay. Ordinary yarns are functional. Since prehistoric times, humankind has used yarns to make textiles that provide protection and beauty. Now, as we want to make textiles from yarns that are multifunctional, and what we put into the yarns determines this extra function, whether it be energy harvesting, energy storage, or energy conversion, or even superconductivity.
So you make the yarns functional by what's inside the yarn.
Uh-huh. And powders are especially important for providing functionality. A challenge in the past is how do you take powders and make them into yarns that are mostly powder without destroying the ability to knit, sew, weave, and braid the yarn. This is the type of problem we solved.
And tell us what kinds of things you could make. I mean, what are the powders made of that you twist into these yarns?
We use, for example, to make superconducting yarns, we use a mixture of magnesium and boron in order to make the superconductor. The fundamental approach, however, is that we take webs of carbon nanotubes. These are little cylinders of carbon. These webs are an unusual state of matter in the sense that they can be lighter than air, but still stronger than, on a per weight basis, than steel. Mm-hmm. We take these carbon nanotube webs and overlay them with powders of the guest material so that we make a yarn eventually that is 95% or even more of powder.
So the yarn just gives it a shape.
The yarn gives strength,
right,
because of the and shape, because of the extremely high mechanical properties of the individual carbon nanotubes. They're able to a few percent of these carbon nanotubes is able to hold together this vastly larger amount of powder.
Huh. So if the powder is made up, let's say, of battery material and you put it into the yarn now just becomes a big battery.
It becomes a battery electrode, and we can make take another yarn, which is the opposite electrode, and twist those two yarns together with a ionically, electronically insulating material in between, and we get a battery.
So your shirt could be a battery.
Even more than that, the individual fibers in your shirt can be individual batteries.
You don't want to get wet.
That's not really a problem because these batteries, the yarns, will be overcoated in such a way that you can't get short.
Yeah, thinking of clothing, but you could make furniture, for example, or car seats and things that could store electricity in them.
You're right on the mark. We can, for example, in automobiles, there's a major effort from a viewpoint of saving energy to make the cars lighter. But on the other hand, people want to have electrical vehicles where you harvest the energy from braking and to power the car at later times. So you want to have a battery or supercapacitor in the car, but batteries and supercapacitors add a lot of weight. If you want to minimize the amount of weight that results from, you can just make, weave these special yarns into a fabric which is placed in the panel of the automobile, which provides strength for the automobile, but also provides the ability to store electricity.
Could you make the car itself, the body, out of, carbon? They have carbon bodies, right? Couldn't you just weave it out of a carbon fabric and store the electricity right in the fender or something?
You're absolutely right. Again, thinking in a lot of our work, most of our work in this new technology was supported by the Air Force. The Air Force is interested in having air vehicles and micro air vehicles that are light, that have longer range, and there that we're talking about having the whole framework of the aircraft be made out of these special multifunctional yarns that provide strength, plus also functions, even the ability, for example, on a micro-air vehicle to morph the wing.
What about storing hydrogen, for example?
That's a good point. Question also. Major problem with conventional hydrogen storage material is that they're powders that break apart when you cycle hydrogen in and out. And there's no real way to get hydrogen in and out of a container of a powder because you have to diffuse through large distances. But if we incorporate our powders for our yarns into the particular geometries that we use, you hold the particles in place so that when we break apart, that doesn't matter, and you can provide a woven vascular system of the yarns that allows easy entrance of the hydrogen and exit of the hydrogen. These powders in our multifunctional yarns are held together in the corridors of scrolls. Think of your rubberized bathroom mat mm-hmm. for the shower. If you twist this mat into a rod by twisting from one side, you get what's called an Archimedean scroll. If you twist another way, you get more complex scrolls. But in each case, the scroll enables the powder to be trapped, so much trapped that we can take our multifunctional yarns and weave them into textiles, wash them vigorously, and we see no change
wow.
in their properties.
Wow. Let me get a quick question from Alicia in Mesa, Arizona. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if these fibers can be used to heat and cool our bodies and indoor environments, and I'm also wondering about therapeutic applications. I'm a nurse. I'm wondering about keeping neonates' bodies at a particular temperature after birth and keeping people cool during surgical procedures and that sort of thing.
Wow.
Oh, very good question. Because the yarns are electrically conducting, we could heat textiles electrically. But you could do this with a ordinary metal wire. More interestingly is we can use multifunctionality to be able to change the porosity of a textile. And that enables heat, for example, for a soldier who's in a hot environment or exercising, that heat and perspiration to evaporate. On the other hand, if he's in a cold or he or she is in a cold environment, you can close the pore structure of the textile.
Wow.
For medical applications, we're collaborating with people in Korea, in Hanyang University, who are working with us to, under a Air Force program to make yarns that can convert sugars in the body into electricity,
wow.
Which could be very important for powering sensors that are in with the body and ultimately, hopefully, even powering a artificial heart.
Amazing. And I'm saying too many wows this segment. Now, how practical, how close are we? And as I say before, and as you said before, these things are washable, right? They will not lose their abilities if you throw them in the laundry.
No, they are very easily washable. For example, we put titanium dioxide, a metal oxide that is can be used to make self-cleaning fibers. We put this within our yarns, within the scrolls of our yarn, in order to make self-cleaning textiles.
Wow. And how soon do you think any of these we'll see in the stores or for our usage?
The main issue is upscaling the quantity of produced materials. Always the issue is how much money is put behind commercializing a technology. I believe that certainly within less than 5 years, you'll see commercial applications of this technology, perhaps even sooner. But again, it's there are no major barriers. When we make our special yarns containing powders by simply taking these webs, these sheets of carbon nanotubes, and painting on top of them the powders, and then twisting the nanotube sheet with overlaid gassed into a yarn. It's very simple.
Huh.
The fundamental technology, the twist aspect, has been practiced since prehistoric times.
Wow, it sounds very – well, we're going to watch what happens.
And Thank you very much.
Pay attention to Dr. Bachman, what's going on there. Very interesting stuff. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
It's my great pleasure to talk to you.
You're welcome. Ray Bachman is director of the Nanotech Institute at the University of Texas at Dallas and professor of chemistry there. Interesting stuff with nanotechnology. Stay with us after the break. Something really interesting and useful you can do at home. Maybe you can't make the yarns. But you can do citizen science projects from gazing at galaxies, solving 3D puzzles, sticking a ruler in the snow, and then tweeting your results. You can be a citizen scientist. We'll tell you how after the break, so stay with us. Next up, Flora Lichtman is here with our digital pick of the week, video pick. What have we got this week, Flora?
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
This week we made a house call to visit a super citizen scientist. Jim Smith is not messing around. I mean, we've been talking about citizen scientists for the last couple minutes, but I think he could give any scientist a real run for their money. He built his own 3D printer, and it's in his living room in the corner.
Of all the places.
It's just amazing.
He doesn't have it out there,
and there's
right?
like a fume duct behind the couch. You know,
oh, by the way, here's my 3D printer.
A few workbenches. It's amazing. It was really neat to see. So he built this and designed it. And I was curious why he would go to the trouble. It costs like $3,000. And you can get open source unassembled kits for less. MakerBot makes one. There's a Cornell group, Fab at Home, that makes one. Why did he do it? So I asked him, and we have a clip from his house.
I don't know. I just was just excited by the possibilities that I can literally just make anything in the computer, and I can just print it out. You know, commercial 3D printers are, you know, way out of my price range, so I really wanted to see if I could make my own. Came up with this.
Now, a 3D printer makes objects, right?
Right. So the basics here are that it takes a computer image, a 3D computer image, and then it prints it out. And in Jim's case, it prints it in plastic. And most of them, it seems, print in plastic. And they print sort of from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And Jim's quote, for me, just epitomizes the spirit of an inventor. You know, he was like, well, if I could make it myself, why not?
Why not? What the heck? Give me a hard one.
It was like magic for me. But he was like, it was okay.
And he went to his apartment and you saw the printer and you made a wonderful video. That's our video pick of the week. It's Flora's video. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. And you can watch this 3D printer print out a very special object for us, right?
Yeah. I mean, this was the thing that was really neat that I sort of understood when I got there. You can customize objects. And so, like, let's say you didn't get your boss a gift for the holidays because you couldn't quite settle on the right one. Maybe.
Make him something special.
Make him something special. So, Ira, here I have something to present to you. This is our production run one.
Oh, it's got a penny stuck into it.
It's a Science Friday bottle opener.
Oh, just what I've always
wanted. What you've always needed. I'm
Science
sure.
Friday. One of its kind, right? There is no other one of these in the world.
Custom plastics. You know how that graduate quote, the plastics?
Plastics.
Now we're talking custom
All right.
plastics.
If you want to see it being built, right, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. It's our video pick of the week. Flora's put that video together, and you can watch how this 3D printer got it all built. Thanks, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
We'll see you next week. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Catherine Wells, Alessio Bayak, Neil Rausch, our technical director, spinning the controls here in New York. And, of course, if you missed any part of the program, go over to our website at sciencefriday.com. If you want to see that 3D printer video up there, it's up there also. Also, all those hashtags for citizen science. If you missed any of them today, you want to be part of those projects, and you want to help reach that 100,000 number, we could use your help. Go to sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
A few years ago, an IBM computer beat Garry Kasparov in a chess match. The question is, can a computer become a Jeopardy champion? IBM seems pretty confident it can. 4 years ago, the company started work on a computer they call Watson, and programmers have been fine-tuning it ever since. And in about a month, Watson will make its debut appearance on Jeopardy, playing against two of the most formidable players of all time. David Ferrucci is IBM's chief scientist behind Watson.
What Watson will appear like to the audience is essentially a screen, a screen of some form, where there's a design on that screen, and it reacts to Watson's different states, whether it's sort of thinking or speaking, and that's all you'll see at the podium. Off stage are the actual computers, the hardware, that is trying to understand and answer the questions.
How does Watson know the answers? I mean, there are an infinite number of topics, questions that could be asked. I mean, is he just loaded with information? Does he have access to infinite data?
No, it doesn't. In fact, Watson, when it plays Jeopardy, is completely self-contained.
Not connected to the internet.
Not connected to the internet. Moreover, I mean, think about it. Even if you were connected to the internet and you got looked at the top 10, 20 documents, let's say the answer was in there somewhere, how do you know what the right answer
right.
is? You have to have a deeper understanding. And that's where all the sort of the analytics come in, these algorithms that run on this hardware to analyze all that data from lots of different dimensions to decide, I think this answer is more right than this other one, and I'm going to compute sort of a probability.
David, let me play a clip of Watson. This is a sort of a trial run on Jeopardy, answering the question correctly.
You got to know when to hold him, know when to fold him. On July 28th, 1994, this Texas Ranger with a familiar name did. Watson?
What is Kenny Rogers?
That is correct. Select again, Watson.
He's talking about Kenny Rogers, a baseball player, not Kenny Rogers, the singer who sang that song. So that was a trick question. How did Watson figure that out?
Watson looks at the different parts of the clue and looks at the date, looks at the names, looks at the times that are referred to, and pieces it all together. So it may find many, many documents that refer to these various elements in the clue. So it's got to knit all those pieces of information together.
But there are cases when he gets it wrong. For example, there's the question to identify the people with the initials LB in the REM song, It's the End of the World as We Know It. And here's how Watson replied.
In REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It, two of the men with the initials LB. Watson?
What is I Feel Fine?
Ooh, no.
I Feel Fine is a lyric in the song,
right.
David. And as an REM fan, I should say the answer was it could have been Lester Bangs, Lenny Bruce, Leonard Brezhnev, Leonard Bernstein. Have you guys worked out the kinks?
So I guess Watson's not an REM
fan. No, he's
fan.
Not an REM fan. But they listen to this show, so they're not going to be happy to hear that.
But I think that's one where it's really not understanding the clue, it's not interpreting the need for those initials, or it's not weighing that enough. And this is an example of Watson looking again at sort of many different dimensions of the clue and what it's reading and analyzing, putting it all together. And in the end, the net isn't favoring the right answer.
So now you guys are clearly confident in all the refining you've done over the years that you're taking Watson to Jeopardy. You're going to put it up against two of the best Jeopardy players of all time. Ken Jennings, he had the longest winning streak. Brad Rutter, he won the most money. Who should I put my money on?
Well, I couldn't tell. That wouldn't be fair if I told you that. What I could tell you is that Watson wins and loses. We've played a series of 55 sparring matches here at IBM against former tournament and champion players. And while we can't release that record yet, I can tell you that, you know, Watson did well enough to give it this television debut. I could also tell you it won and it lost. So it's going to be an interesting and I think, at least for me, edge of my seat contest.
That's David Ferrucci, the scientist who led the team that created the IBM computing system Watson, which is set to appear on Jeopardy next month. David, thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It's now time for All Tech Considered. Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, turns 10 this week. And if you've been on the site lately, you've seen a banner ad floating atop your search result that says, "Please read an urgent appeal from Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales." It's a plea for donations because Wikipedia does not use advertising. Wikipedia recently reached its $16 million goal. And to tell us what that $16 million is for, here's the founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales, who joins us from London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And first, what are you going to use the $16 million for?
Well, the money that we get goes to several different things. Primarily, it's to keep the site on the air. That's our first and most fundamental goal at the Wikimedia Foundation. So we have the servers and the bandwidth, the developers. We have the site administrators, the technical operations people who keep the site running. And then, of course, in the office, we have all of the normal functions of a nonprofit. But this year, we're actually engaging in some new projects. We're going to open our first office outside the U.S. in India to help further the growth of Wikipedia in the Indian languages.
The operation that you're running seems so huge, the number of entries that are out there and the number of people using it. Just feels like $16 million seems like an awfully slim sum. I mean, it's obviously a lot of money. It sounds rather little. You're actually doing what is the actual budget of the operation?
Well, Our annual budget for the coming year is $20.1 million. So we raised $16 million in the annual campaign. We have money that comes in throughout the year from small donors. We have some grants, some major donors. It is a small amount of money. I mean, it's really astounding what we've been able to do with such a small amount of money. But in part, it's because of our nature as an online organization, as a really community-driven organization, where all of the things that you see on the website are really in the hands of the volunteers and all of their social structures and things like that. And the foundation's job is primarily to keep the site on the air.
If one could calculate the ratio of users of any outlet or publication in any medium, including the web, to the number of employees or budgeted dollars at that outlet, Wikipedia would have to have the highest ratio on Earth. What would it be? As far as I'm aware, yes. What do you think it would be?
Well, we have around 50 employees right now. We're going to hire a few more this year. And we have about 400 million visitors to the website every month. So, you know, each of the employees is responsible for about 8 million people. That's pretty amazing if you think about it.
Here's an example of Wikipedia in action and displaying a weakness. On Saturday, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot. And in a very unfortunate moment, NPR had two sources, as it turned out, two bad sources, saying that she died. At least two cable channels, CNN and Fox, said they confirmed our bad story. As we were getting it wrong, you were getting it wrong. Wikipedia was getting it wrong along, too. I could tell you who got it wrong here, but at Wikipedia, a contributor identified only as 138.47.108.25 got it wrong. Why does anyone can edit mean anyone can edit anonymously?
Well, I mean, in a case like this, of course, I don't think it shows a weakness in Wikipedia. I think we ran with the story for the same reason that lots of people did. And it was actually very interesting to look at the discussion and debate that emerged afterwards, detailing specifically, well, how should we handle this? What should we tell people and when and so forth? So it's quite an interesting community.
But in this community, for example, I read about one of the contributors who took part in the wiki edit of the Gabrielle Giffords entry. He's C.Fred. I know where he went to college, what he does for a living, that he's interested in the interstate highway system and the difference between Canadian football and U.S. football, but not his name. He doesn't sign with a name and take responsibility for his contribution. Why not?
Well, I mean, I think from our perspective, when we've looked at it, it really comes from a purely empirical question, which is to say, does it really make any difference? If I look at your work and I see you're doing really good work, knowing your actual name doesn't seem to really enhance anything or add anything to that. Now, if we did a look at everything and we saw that, gee, when people supply their real name, they do a really great job, and if they don't supply a real name, they do a really lousy job, obviously we would change things. But it doesn't seem to actually matter.
How many people are there who are contributing and editing items on Wikipedia?
Well, it's hard to really come up with a single number because some people are extremely active. They're on the website every day. This is the core community. Of those, there's a few thousand. Then there's a broader group of people who are semi-regular editors and you know, contribute from time to time. And we would say there's probably around 100,000 of those. And then there's a lot more people who just may make one or two edits every now and then. They see a little something wrong and they just chip in and help out.
Is there a profile of a contributor to Wikipedia that would pretty much describe the typical contributor or no such thing?
Yeah, we've done some user surveys to find out who's contributing to Wikipedia. The average age is around 26. We're about 85% male, which is something we'd like to change in the future.
85% male?
85% male. We think that's because of our tech geek roots, and I think it reflects a broader issue in society in many ways. But we're hoping, as we change the software to make it more accessible for more people to edit, that you shouldn't need to be a computer geek. We want to be welcoming to geeks who aren't computer geeks.
How would you describe your ambitions for the second 10 years of Wikipedia's existence?
Well, the main thing that we're focused on going forward is the expansion of Wikipedia into the languages of the developing world. When we look at the really large, really successful Wikipedia languages, they are essentially the European languages, Japanese and Chinese. And then beyond that, it falls off fairly quickly. And what we're really looking at is where are the places that we see a lot of activity that can be really supported and extended so that we can really fulfill the dream of Wikipedia, which is a free encyclopedia for every single person on the planet in their own language.
Are you all involved in apps and in access on mobile phones and the like, and thinking that that's where the action is going to be for Wikipedia? Or, like those of us who hang out in radio still, are you committed to the old-fashioned web?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Certainly we do want to be active in the apps world and make sure that on mobile devices that Wikipedia is as usable as possible, because in particular in the developing world, we know that tons of people are going to come online for the first time via mobile devices, and so that's a really important component of things. On the other hand, I haven't decided yet if I'm just old-fashioned and wrong or if I'm right, but someone asked me recently, did you see the Wired magazine's big story about the web being dead? And I said, yeah, I did see it. I read it on the web, so we'll see.
Well, Jimmy Wales, good luck in the future at Wikipedia, and thanks for talking with us today.
All right, thanks.
So Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, the site turns 10 years old on January 15th.
This is NPR.